Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, this is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent a desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity, and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And we invite you to share comments and ideas at Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the microphone and to our show today Gary Barg, editor-in-chief of Today's Caregiver, the website caregiver.com, and the organizer of a series of Fearless Caregiver conferences. Welcome, Gary. Thank you for joining us. Gary? Hello? And we have some technical difficulties. I have no idea what is going on here.
Well, he appears to be online. I don't know why he's not picking up with you. Maybe we'll have to call him back. Give me just a minute, and we'll see what we can do with him.
Okay. The wonders of technology. Anyway, Gary is involved seriously in this magazine, website, using radio. The issue of caregiving becomes, well, Gary calls it the great equalizer, and for those of us who've walked this walk and we know exactly the stresses and strains, I think if you lined up every clergy person in your particular area and asked them if they have had serious conversations, concerns, really soul-searching conversations with a congregant about their own journey, this congregant's journey with caregiving, they would all indicate absolutely.
So, Rabbi, now, I think we have Gary on the phone with us.
Okay, I hope. Gary?
I hope so, too. Rabbi, are you there?
I'm here. Okay, we were just doing some outline work. There's the beauty of technology. Anyway, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, as I was saying to myself, thank you.
No. Listen. Okay. So today's caregiver and the caregiver.com website and the conferences. What really motivated you? How did you start this? Obviously, or obviously, I'm going to think that you had a personal experience which motivated you.
Well, you know, it. I know your story, and also every advocate and everybody I know who does great work supporting caregivers, when you drill down, it starts from a personal challenge. And ours was, I was in Atlanta getting set up to do video work for the 96 Olympics in 1994. And by then, my dad had retired and developed bone marrow cancer, passed away. And my grandfather and my grandmother were showing signs of anything you can think of down here in South Florida. So this summer of 94, I came down to visit my mom. And once I saw what she was going through, I couldn't just let her do it alone anymore. Because, you know, a lot of times caregivers will hide this from their family members. They don't want anyone to see. They don't want anyone to suffer. They want people going through what they're going through. And mom was doing a great job of that. So we really never knew. And so I came back to support mom as she cared for my grandparents. I call it being a caregiver's caregiver. And as I walked around, I got the best advice and support and wisdom and tips from the fellow family caregivers I met. And I had a media background, and it just occurred to me that, you know, there was nothing for caregivers. And so we started Today's Caregiver magazine, which rolled off the press July 4th in 1995, and got caregiver.com and started hosting conferences. And I've spent the last 23 years spending time in rooms with who I call the greatest healthcare heroes in the world, family caregivers. So it's been a blessing for me.
The magazine, just let's cut to the chase right away. If someone wants to get this or get a hold of it, how does one access the magazine?
they could go on caregiver.com. It's digital. It's free. They come to caregiver.com. They download it. They, you know, and they get the information. We have two weekly newsletters of a lot of times the information we learn from the family caregivers when we travel the country with the Fearless Caregiver Conferences, and we share that on our newsletters or our celebrity interviews or interviews with leading experts in family caregiving or, you know, tips and information and advice. So when they come to caregiver.com, they could sign up for a free newsletter, and they can actually, you know, get a complimentary copy of the digital magazine.
So the magazine access through caregiver.com. Talk to me a little bit about these conferences, the Fearless Caregiver Conference. First of all, it's a great name, and they're all over the country. How do you and who's eligible? Is it free? How is it publicized?
Yeah. You know, when we started in 95 in South Florida, we were very regional. And the people I talked to said, this is great, but how can we get together? And we started a conference at Nova Southeastern University, had 400 caregivers, had Robert Urich there. And it was such a love fest. It was such an information fest. The caregivers were sharing wisdom with one another that we said we got to keep this going. And as of December, we had hosted our 210th Fearless Caregiver Conference, and our next one is February 8th in Boynton Beach, Florida. And we work very carefully. You know, I always say that all caregiving is national in implication and local in application. So for me to just come into a city and say, here we are, we're going to talk to you about caregiving, is helpful and it's lovely, but it doesn't really solve the challenge. So we work with all the local organizations. In Boynton, we're working with the Palm Beach Treasure Coast Area Agency on Aging, and we're working with the Alzheimer's Association, Palm Healthcare Foundation, and Healthier Boynton. And as we travel the country, we only want to do it when we can work with the local organizations, because once we leave and we get, hopefully the day is a day where caregivers realize they're not alone. The questions are important. There's a lot of advice and support in the community, and we want to put their hands in the hands of their local partners, and that seems to work extremely well no matter where we are around the country. So it's always free for family caregivers. I mean, you know, there are vendors and people with booths and who have information and advice and support for caregivers, but I never want to charge a caregiver anything to come. You know, it's just they have enough on their head. Why should they have to pay to come to the event? So, yeah, go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Finish.
Oh, and the way the day works is we don't have breakouts. We don't have people speechifying and PowerPointing and, you know, pontificating. It's all about answering the questions of the caregivers. The caregivers are in the room together. We are in the room with the microphones, getting them to open up and answer questions. We have generally have a panel of experts or experts in front of them. And it's really after the day gets started, the caregivers are answering each other's questions so brilliantly that sometimes you don't know who the caregiver is and who the expert is. And it's because I think all caregivers are experts. You know, all caregivers have a piece of the puzzle. And so that's how the day works.
We know that a lot of this caregiving, if not all of it, is done in what I call splendid isolation.
Yeah.
One of the issues that you tackled in one of your recent magazines, I think it was the November-December 2017 issue, is something that I still think doesn't get enough attention and comes up a lot, and that is the issue of caregiver self-care, taking care of myself, eating right, nutrition, exercise, just some respite care, and in the process of my taking care of someone else. Could you just, in your experience, in your writing, in your conferences, the role of self-care, and is it becoming more and more and more important?
Well, the thing is, it's where it starts. You know, caregivers, I always say it's the most selfless kind of love. But the challenge is, unless you're well, unless you're healthy, unless you're, you know, taking care of yourself, you can't stand up and take care of your loved one. And I always say to caregivers when they won't, you know, talking to a caregiver and they won't take care of themselves, I'll say, okay, that's fine. Don't take care of yourself. But tell me who's going to step in and care for both of you when you fall apart due to not caring for yourself, due to stress, due to, you know, the effects that you're taking yourself out of the circle of care has to do. And nobody ever has an answer. So I think job one for any caregiver, to be the best caregiver you can, is to do what you can to care for yourself first. Very quickly, there is all sorts of statistics about caregiving now, but the one that I learned about 12 years ago that still strikes me as hard as any statistic is Stanford University came up with a study that showed that when your loved one's dealing with a cognitive issue, you know, Alzheimer's, PICS, any kind of dementia, you're 40% more likely to die before they do due to the effects of stress. That's it. You know, so it's a real world issue to take care of, to self care. It's the cornerstone of any family caregiving.
Yeah, and you're correct. I mean, there are increasing numbers of studies as the boomers age, and we've walked this walk with our own parents. The number of studies and articles dealing with self care and the implications of stress and strain on the individual, psychically, emotionally, financially, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about in your work, in the articles, and in the conferences, the importance, the impact of what we call in our program the economics of aging, the sheer stress on caregiving and family on how to pay for all of this.
Absolutely. Well, what I always say is that, you know, when you take on the role of caregiving, you become CEO of Caring for Your Loved One, Inc. You're in charge. You need to know the finances, and you need to know how to care for your loved one. You need to know the services available to you. And it's a great impact on you and your family members, the impact of the financial impact of caregiving. So we have a few things. One is when you find out who the resources in your community are, a lot of times there's support. There's, you know, DME equipment. There's incontinence materials. There's respite that you would never know about through the ARI agency, the ADRC, the Alzheimer's Association, and different organizations in your town, unless you reach out and talk to other caregivers and find out who these solution providers are. The other one is getting your family members to help, which I know everybody is now laughing because that's the hardest thing a caregiver can do. But
right.
We have something called the reverse gift list that you can find on caregiver.com, where we kind of train caregivers on what to ask for, how to ask for, and how to always get the get. So, you know, a sister-in-law who's not doing much help, maybe the only thing that she does is pay for the incontinence supplies, that's enough. You know, a cousin who lives in the next community, the son's good with mechanics, maybe he can come over and take care of the car. There's elements of your caregiving that you can actually parse out if you know what to ask for, who to ask, and how to ask.
Let me ask you a question following up on that, because this comes up, I know, in clergy offices all the time and counselor, pastoral counseling, dealing with individuals who are caregivers, where family of origin issues pop up. You know, the designated, we know the statistics that the average caregiver in the United States is a woman somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 years of age, also working in many cases, and the stress and strain dealing with estrangement. In other words, I'm going to be taking care of mom and dad, mom and or dad, but there has been a family estrangement, and I'm even more isolated than in a normal situation because the relationships I have with my siblings, we don't have that relationship anymore, and or even, you know, as I'm sure you've run into in these conferences, a strained relationship with the person I'm having to care for, how do I overcome that? Can you just I'm sure these things have come up in your conferences. How, in your experience, these have been discussed or even dealt with?
Absolutely, and you hit the nail on the head. That's an issue that most, if not all, caregivers face. Maybe you have a core of your family members who help, but outside of that, nobody's helping. Or I find that caregiving exacerbates family dynamics. Good dynamics get better, and bad dynamics tend to crack. So when I say you're the CEO of Caring for Your Loved One, Inc., what you need to do is figure out the dynamics with any particular member of your family, how you can address that conversation about caregiving with them in particular, and what you can ask for from them that makes them feel involved without, overwhelming them. And we just came out of the holidays, and there's something I call the board of directors meetings. You know, the family comes together, and they're sitting together at the holidays, and instead of them all coming in and telling you what you're not doing right, or why do you think Dad shouldn't drive? He looks great, or, whatever it is. I think that these are great opportunities to actually know what you need to get from your family members, know the conversations you need to have, and sit down after your loved one's gone to bed and you're all sitting around after dinner and have these board of directors meetings. And one night it might be, let's talk about hospice, and have the material at hand and have the expertise to share with your family members. So it's not just an emotional thing. Or maybe the next night, let's talk about the driving issue. So, I say, if you're the CEO and they're the board of directors, then basically, you're running the show. And that seems to work very well, because it's a mindset that you take on as a family caregiver of how to manage these relationships. And sometimes when it's a broken relationship, sometimes it's and you can't do anything, it's better to know that so you can move on and try to fix the ones that are fixable.
And that's where I'm sure a friendship network sometimes,
yeah,
as we've all run into, takes the place of a familial network. In the magazine, if I'm not mistaken, you have something called Care Verses.
Yes.
What are they?
Well, one of the things that I've always heard from family caregivers is that caregiving brings out so much of them, and a lot of times it brings out their artistic abilities they didn't even know they had. And many times that is exemplified in prose. And people will send poems. The very first one, this is in the old days when the fax machines would just slowly spew out paper, a lady called and said, I'm reading your magazine. I think we've been out about a year at that point. And I just had this idea, and I wanted to write it down, and it's a poem, and if you want to use it, please do. But I know it's silly and it's no good. And as it was coming over the fax, I started crying, because when you touch the heart of a caregiver and a caregiver is trying to express himself artistically, it's beautiful. And so in every single issue of every single magazine, there's been enough of these poems that we call them Care Verses. Every one is written by a non-professional writer, not a poet, family caregiver. And we've gotten such great response from that I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you.
No, the reason why I ask is because, to be honest with you, I've had some recent conversations with caregivers, and we also do a lot of work in ritual creation, and have found that the creation of a prayer, the creation of a meditation, can sometimes be quite beneficial for not only for the caregiver, but for both the person being cared for. Which kind of like leads me to the next issue. In all of the work that you're doing with today's caregiver and caregiver.com and the Fearless Caregiver conferences, what's the role of spirituality and faith in these conversations?
I'm so glad we're talking about that. And whenever we talk to caregivers about, there are horrors in caregiving. There's challenges. There's pain. There's, you know, you're taking yourself out of the circle of care. You're sleeping an hour a night. You're worrying all the time. You're at work, you know, what they call presenteeism, where you're there, but you're on the phone dealing with issues of your loved one. And you would think that this would tear you away from your idea of spirituality, to tear you away from your God because of what is happening and how terrible things are and how could God do this to you. I have never seen that. Every time we talk about that with family caregivers, and every study I've ever seen says that caregiving leads people to be closer to their religion, to their spirituality, to their God than they were before.
It's interesting you mention that because, well, you know, obviously I'm going to agree with you in a way, but I've also seen, you know, I'm sure you've had these conversations in the conferences where the anger quotient, you know, I was forced into doing this. Why is this happening? Why is this? Why did this happen to my mother? And why is this happening to me? Which are deeply profound spiritual questions. And I'm sure you've run into these because, look, part of all of this, which is an obvious issue that I'm sure you've dealt with, is this whole issue of loss and how do you turn, because caregiving involves loss in many ways. How do you turn that loss into something positive? Is perhaps the wrong word, but something that is perhaps, well, we'll use positive since I can't come up
beneficial.
With a better word. Beneficial is a good word. As I'm sure these conversations have happened a lot in the conferences.
Well, as we started talking about how I got involved, how you got involved, I think that once you learn from what you've learned from being a family caregiver and succeeded in how you've succeeded and dealt with the trials and the tribulations of it, a lot of times it's, even though your friends say, okay, now go on a cruise, now don't worry about it, but a lot of times you can't stop. You can't put it down. It's changed you to where I know people have gone back and gotten their social work degree. People have gone back and gotten their nursing degree. People have started radio shows. You know, people around the country have started radio programs based on this issue just to stay in contact, stay in communication, run support groups. And there's nothing more important to me than for family caregivers than to get involved with the appropriate, well-led support group, because that's your family of choice. Mm-hmm. Those are the people who you can say anything to, and those are the people who help you process better than anyone who's not going through it. And so I always say that rather than thinking a support group is some place where people are just sitting around whining and complaining, it's not true. These are people who understand you. These are people who become your family. Even if you have a wonderful relationship with your family, these are people you can say anything to and learn from and open yourself up to. So, I think after caregiving, there's a lot of people who have found that it's changed them profoundly in the sense that it's changed the direction of their life.
The power of the support group, in a non-judgmental way, I'm sure. And I know more and more communities, congregations, Jewish Family Services, JCCs are offering support groups to really, because it is in essence a caregiving tsunami that we are involved with now, especially as baby boomers age. And then we turn to the obvious question of, will our children be able to step up to the plate in the same way that many baby boomers stepped up to the plate for our parents? So in the little bit of time we have left, I'm going to play around with a little bit of blue sky brainstorming. You know, you're invested in it, Barry, 100%, the magazine, the website, the conferences. But there's a reality existing, known to every one of us who have been a caregiver, about not only the economics, mm-hmm. but the fact that the society may not even be paying attention, enough attention to this. Could you just share some of your thoughts about looking
sure.
looking 5-10 years ahead of time, and we know that the government, I think the president just signed the RAISE bill, which gives some credit and breaks to family caregiving. And I know that there's legislation in a variety of different states and tax credits for this, that, and the other thing. But looking ahead, where do you see this challenge going?
Well, thank you for that, because I think that is two extremely important points there. One is about our kids. I always say that little pitchers don't only have big ears, they have big eyes. And they're watching how you care for your loved one, and that's how you'll be cared for. And I always say to caregivers in my conferences, you're doubly blessed because your kids are learning from you, even if you're not, you know, outwardly teaching them. They're seeing you go to the long-term care facility. They're seeing you hug your mom. They're seeing you feed your dad. They're seeing this. And that's the best lesson that a caregiver can impart to their child. Second thing is, I always say that if every single caregiver in the country, all 66.7 million of us, went on a cruise for a year, walked away, somehow the system would have to find $500 billion to replace what we do for free and out of love. But it's also killing us. So the RAISE Act is a great start. One of the things it does is it actually demands that government comes up with a plan in a set amount of time. Say, okay, now you must come up with a plan to support caregivers. And second, once they find the economic support, the benefit to the federal government, the state government, the benefit to our communities to support caregivers, maybe then the support that we get that when our loved ones go in the facility, maybe we can get that support at home. Maybe we can get the financial support and the care management. And all of a sudden you'll find that this becomes more a professional. We always like to say our role is to professionalize the system, humanize the system, and professionalize the family caregiver. And so that's where I think we're going. I think we have to go, because we can't just leave this on the shoulder of our caregivers any longer, because who's going to care for the caregivers? And that's why I'm glad you brought up the RAISE Act, because it's a start. It's beginning. And once they find with the valuable data, like Mrs. Carter's organization does, testing these things and find out that they test out and that they save money and they save lives, all of a sudden I think involving our family caregivers into the system of support, of finance, you know, like other countries do, is not actually an expense. It's an investment.
Well, the idea of investment, I think you're right. The investment, it's really investing in the future. And given the political realities right now, I mean, what you're talking about is it has to be on the front burner of every adult, and certainly not only the boomers, but our kids as well, because the world is changing. And yet, the issue of caregiving and continues to grow. I thank you very, very much. Real fast, again, if somebody wants to tap into the magazine, the conferences, what's the access point?
877-829-2734 or caregiver.com.
Caregiver.com. Give me a number again, just in case.
877-829-2734.
And in the 1 minute we have left on this segment, this is the easiest question of all. Of all the conferences, of everything, you now have that opportunity. What's the one piece of advice that you would give to every single caregiver?
Stay involved. I'm going to cheat because I'm going to give you more than one. Stay involved. Find out who the solution providers in your community are. Go to support groups. Care for yourself. Make sure you're getting the proper nutrition, the proper rest, the proper support, and ask questions. Ask questions, ask questions, ask questions, and don't stop until you get qualified responses from anybody, from the insurance company, from the government, from your doctors, because you are the manager of this. You are the CEO of Caring for Your Loved One, Inc., and you deserve it.
Gary Barg, the editor-in-chief of Today's Caregiver and caregiver.com, and the organizer of the Fearless Caregiver Conferences. Thank you very, very much for joining us. Continue. Good luck, success. Talk to you later, Gary. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi. Take care.
We'll be right back after this message.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Shalom. It's a pleasure to welcome to the microphone here for Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, Rabbi Steve Foster. We're recording this at the convention of the National Association of Retired Reform Rabbis in beautiful downtown Boca Raton, Florida. We're here for the annual convention of Na'or, and Steve Foster is about to be named president of Na'or. So, Steve, welcome. Welcome.
Thanks. Rabbi
Richie, how are you?
It's always been Richie, but I want to be. That's okay. Thanks for inviting me.
No, this is wonderful, and I thank you for giving up your time in the middle of a crazy convention day. Just tell me real fast. Let's start with the basics. What is Na'or? Why was it created?
So Na'or is a 35-year-old organization. It was created out of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. For rabbis who are retired or are getting ready to retire, I think mostly at the time it was to help them into retirement, to make it this is not about finances. This was about making this sacred work of which we have been a part continue in some way without putting us in a position of being in competition with the rabbis who took over our congregations. How do we find that? And I think its real focus in the beginning was to find ways for rabbis to have a meaningful retirement, not just financial retirement, but a meaningful retirement to continue to do some of the things in ways that we can in the future.
So this is the 35th?
I think this is the 34th or 35th. What is this?
According to the paper, 35.
Oh, 35. So this is the 35th conference.
You've been involved with it for a couple of... What's the change? How has this changed? This is not just a meeting of old rabbis sitting around reminiscing of the good old days.
It's not. But I do remember that my predecessor in Denver, with whom I worked for 11 years before I took over for him, because I've been in Denver 47 years.
Wow.
Rabbi Earl Stone was the second president of this organization.
Oh, wow.
And I just remember him talking about it was how meaningful it was to him to be able to meet with some of his retired colleagues, and that they had something to offer. And that they were offering it at the time to each other, scholarship and listening to each other and talking through the issues that were of concern to them. But I think there is a change.
And what would that, if you could pinpoint it, what would that be?
I think the change today is that the rabbis are, in retirement, are looking for ways in which we can continue to use our own abilities to change the world in a certain way. We just heard a phenomenal speaker, David Saperstein, whom all of us love and so on. And he really challenged us to not be silent, even though we're retired, not to be silent, to pick up the challenge of the things that are going on, and to utilize our abilities and our influence to make the difference. And he believes that we still can do that. I believe that we still can do that. That makes our retirement meaningful. It's not a matter of, I mean, I like to play golf, but, you know, during the summer, I play golf a couple mornings a week. That's enough.
Mm-hmm.
I still need other things, and I have found other things for myself, but everybody needs something to make their life meaningful.
You keep using the word meaningful, and certainly in our work in Jewish Sacred Aging, as we go around, the concept of finding meaning in this third stage of life keeps coming up over and over and over again.
The third stage of my youth, middle age, and you're looking well.
For your age. Yeah. or whatever. Fill in the blank. So this concept of finding meaning, what are you seeing in some of the colleagues who you're working with, or how they're really transforming their own sense of retirement and finding meaning? Are people still staying involved within the Jewish community? Are they really branching out in ways we could not have understood in previous years?
I think in some ways, I think it's across the board.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, there are some rabbis who, there's one rabbi who came to me yesterday. He said, I'm a full-time Democrat. Could have been Republican, but he said, I'm a full-time Democrat. And I spend my life working through the process of the Democratic Party, not because I'm planning to run for office, but because I want to see the people who are doing the things that need to be done to see that they get elected. That was one person. One person came to me and he said, I'm working as a volunteer in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Another person like me, I have a part-time job in retirement. Look, I had a big congregation. You know that.
Right.
I had a huge congregation. I had a lot of responsibility. And one day I'm done. So the question is, what was I going to do with my life? It just so happens that a hospice in our community that I used to be on their board came to me and asked, would you come work part-time? So I do 10 to 15 hours a week, and it gives purpose and structure,
right,
and meaning to me. People are going to volunteer work. People are going to congregational life and to help other congregations get through some of the difficulties. Some people are working in public schools and trying to teach kids to read and to write and so on. So I think that it's a broad spectrum, a many, many faceted way of people finding things to do that will make a difference in their lives, certainly, but in other lives. That's what makes life better for them.
Are you going to be involved as Na'ur, as the Association of Retired Reform Rabbis, going to be involved with this? We just also heard an announcement of a task force that's going to try to look at these last 2 years before a colleague retires in this transition.
Right.
Very, very crucial time.
I hope that the conference, which is putting this committee together, will look to Na'ur. I only found out about it a couple of days ago. But I will talk to Peter, and because I do think that there needs to be some input from Na'ur,
the people who've done it,
and not just from people within the CCAR that need to have a place that they will hold on some committee.
If you were talking to somebody who's saying, okay, this is the beginning of 2018, and I'm announcing my retirement from my congregation June 2019, so I'm on the 18-month plan, and I'll figure it out. What advice would you give to that colleague?
Well, the first advice, which is probably contrary to what the CCAR would have said, because in my own case, as we use my case, mm-hmm, I went to my congregation 2.5 years before I retired. And I sent a letter to my congregation that I was retiring when I hit 67, 40 years, 2010. I'm going to retire then. And the CCAR said, please don't do that. It's not a good idea. And I said, there's two reasons I'm doing it. Number one, I'm doing it because I think for the congregation that I've served for almost 40 years, I think before they hire somebody to take them someplace, a new rabbi, they got to know where they want to go. And I believe in that process. And so I said, I'm doing that because I don't want you to just hire somebody. I want you to hire somebody because you think that that person has the same values, the same sense of what you want, so that he or she can lead you in a new direction. They finally did that. And I think that part of their process of looking for a new rabbi had to do with that fact. The second reason I wanted to go and tell them early is because I really did need to find something meaningful for me. Right. Although I didn't for those first 2.5 years and 2.5 years between writing and retirement. And if you ask my wife, Joyce would say, I wasn't happy for the first 2 or 3 years after I retired. I didn't think it took that long, but it's hard to leave a position that you have loved and that in some cases, not all cases, some people cared about you. In my case, look, I realized I was in a place for 40 years before I retired. I made lots of friends and I made some enemies too. But we did make friends, and it's hard to give it up. And it's hard to give up those life cycle moments in their lives because they're also moments in our life.
Sure, sure.
But it had to be done. It had to be done if the next rabbi is going to succeed. And you can't just have a void. You have to have something to fill that void. You have to have, I hate to use the word again, meaningful applications for my life and for somebody else's life. And so that's what I would tell a rabbi who is getting ready to retire, or anybody who's getting ready to retire, that you have to plan it. You'll make mistakes, but you have to figure out what you're going to do with that time.
Is there an element of faith in this, Steve? A faith in oneself and faith in the fact that something will emerge and you will find that sense of meaning?
I don't think it's not a blind faith for me. I've always had a sense that things, yes, will work out, but I've always had faith in myself that I wouldn't just sit back no matter what it's ever been in my life. I never just sat back and said, let it happen. That was never me. So I always had faith that I would try to make something happen. But I don't think you can retire and be satisfied in retirement without making some significant changes and planning for what you're going to do with your time. What you're going to do with your time? I mean, you know, look, you're in the rabbinate and you understand this. I did 60 hours a week for 40 years.
And that was normal.
And it was normal.
Normal.
I was always either doing something. And then all of a sudden,
the phone stops ringing.
And well, not entirely, yeah. But it's not the same thing. And also, in my case, I also did not want to be in the way of Black, my successor.
Right.
And I was very conscious of that. So I didn't go to the temple. I have an office there. I was entitled to spend time there and have a secretary if I needed. I have made it my determined way of working is not to be the temple. I don't think I go to the temple an hour a week.
So what do you say, since you've walked this walk and now you're president of the Retired Reform Rabbis Association, what do you say to those colleagues who they just can't let go?
Yeah, well,
they just can't let go.
They have to let go because they're hurting their congregations. They're hurting them. And I know situations.
Yeah, we all know situations.
They are hurting their congregations, and they are hurting the people who have come in to take over for them in a way that we went to congregations when we were younger and people wanted us to do certain things. Well, they want the rabbi to have some freedom. And the only people sometimes that are keeping them from doing that are the retired rabbis and the people that the retired rabbi will speak to and sort of say, oh, things are terrible, but don't tell anybody.
Right, right, right. I would have done it differently.
You know.
The fifth column.
It's terrible. And I know what happened.
No, I know too.
And I know that sometimes in congregational life, congregants want it to happen because they want to sort of be koch leffel.
Right.
They want to
stir the pot.
And I think rabbis who are retiring or who are retired have to really be conscious of the fact that they have a responsibility to the next person who's taking over to help them. And the way you can help them the most is by being available to them, number one, and Joe and I have this wonderful relationship. He'll say, do you know this family? And I'll say, yes, and tell me about them. So I'll tell him about a family because it's helping him become the rabbi to that community. And it's okay. I have found it okay. First 4 years for the holidays, high holy days, I was gone. Now, some people would say, get out of town altogether. And I would say, I can't and won't and don't want to, not just because of the position I had, but because my family all lives in Denver. You know, my children, three children, we all live within a mile of each other. And my grandchildren, I mean, where am I going to go?
Yeah.
I mean, I want to be with my family. So I had to be extra careful, I think, to make sure that what I was trying to do was something that would be helpful to my successor. And it's not been perfect. He and I are going to do a session tomorrow. Tomorrow morning, while you're doing one session.
Right. I know you're doing your thing.
I'm going to do a session with Joe.
The population of Na'or, I think the perception is predominantly congregational rabbis, but the nature of the rabbinate is changing and the huge influx of non-congregational rabbis. So has this begun to impact Na'or, people who have chaplains or academics or people who have not served congregations?
There are some, but not a lot. I will have to say that most of the people that I see are people who have had congregational positions. And I think we're going to have to make sure that we open and be open to people who were not congregational rabbis who are retiring. And maybe it will be more difficult for them, especially academics. I think academics, but there aren't too many academics in our organizations, mostly retired congregational rabbis, mostly.
And so now we're seeing the first generation of women who are retiring, and we just heard a report about that as well. So do you anticipate, I know Connie Golden, our colleague, is the immediate past president. Is there going to be an attempt on the OR to try to recruit or be more involved with getting more women involved as they retire?
That was one of Connie's outreach efforts during this last year. I'm going to continue that. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do yet, but yes, I want to continue that and perhaps have a task force of NAOR members reaching out in different ways to the women who are getting ready to retire. And I think we have to be very, very conscious of that and lift them up and make contact with them and encourage them to come in, because I think there's a lot of camaraderie here that is helpful for retired rabbis.
If I'm not mistaken, one of the strengths of Na'or historically has been support of spouses and surviving spouses of colleagues who have passed away. Could you just talk about that? Because a lot of times in the general society, these people are forgotten and function totally alone. But that's not the case with you, is it?
Well, I don't think it's the case with us, but I'm not sure we have done a good job of doing everything we can do to really be conscious and to bring them in. It's another thing that we've been talking about. We're not doing enough programmatically for widows, and eventually it's going to be widowers too.
Mm-hmm.
Because
spouses.
We're not doing enough. Yes, we have outreach efforts to make sure that we don't leave them without phone calls and all of the rest, but programmatically we're not doing enough, and I hope that by next year we will be able to. I met with the next year's program committee at lunch today, and I said we can't forget that. It's not enough to just have things that the rabbis care about. We also have to have things that we all care about, and that we're all in this together.
The Noor is specifically the Reform Rabbi. Do you know if there in the conservative movement or other movements there's a similar organization?
I don't know that, but I know that there was a conservative rabbi here from their organization, and I'm sure that that's one of the things that brought him here, is that he wants to as the other as they always do, which is great. The Reform movement is the creative arm of American Jewish life. We do the things that need to be done. We respond to issues. And as we do that, other parts of the Jewish community, other streams, so to speak, learn of it, find out that it's successful, that it reaches a group of people, and they try it as well. So, yes, I think that they will, but I don't know that that is in the works for the conservative movement or Orthodox movement.
Would Noor open up a membership to retired rabbis of other denominations?
You'd have to change its name.
Yeah, well, maybe not.
Well, you would. It's three R's. It's National Association of
Retired Reform Rabbis.
So, look, we are a region, considered to be a region of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, like PAR or Midwest, New York. I mean, we're a region of the CCAR, and we have, I don't think it would open itself up to anybody.
That's interesting, because given the changes in the rabbinate and the number of really non-denominational rabbis that are popping up all over the place, and a lot of second career. We just interviewed a couple of people on the show. I think it was in December, a 58-year-old guy and a 75-year-old guy who are in seminaries. I mean, they're non-traditional seminaries, but they're going to...
Sure.
So it's a very different world.
A very different world than
a long time ago.
I would like to see us, perhaps, maybe we'll do this for next year. I don't know. It's really up to the program committee, although I'll be president, but, we'll see. I wouldn't mind if some members of the conservative movement who want to come to the conference could come. I mean, that would be fine with me.
Yeah.
Could they become members? I don't think so.
Who knows? Who knows?
At this point. It
would be very interesting and especially where you're going to be next year on the West Coast. There's a whole rich community out there in the Los Angeles, San Diego quadrant there.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, question.
So we're speaking with Rabbi Steve Foster, the new president of NAOR, the National Association of Retired Reform Rabbis. Before you go and assume your presidential duties,
which isn't much.
Keeps you busy.
Yeah.
But looking forward to this next year, what's your vision?
For NAOR?
For NAOR.
Well, one of the things that I've been talking about is that I think that hopefully, and we have to do this in conjunction with the CCAR, hopefully we might be able to have some kind of influence on the issues of the day that the conference deals with. So, for example, I would love to see NAOR have a permanent place on the Social Action Commission, so that Naor could perhaps bring a resolution or two a year as it affects seniors, not just rabbis, but seniors, so that we could make sure that the Social Action Commission doesn't forget that there is a group of senior people out there. We've been talking about the possibility, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to do some of that. We've talked about trying to find ways of having more than one opportunity in a year to be together. I don't know that that would mean another conference. I'm not sure that we could do that, but some people have talked about regional conferences, or some people have talked about having people get together. So we may do some of that. I don't know. We will reach out to the Women's Rabbinic Network even more than we have. And we will still stay open for business in terms of the things that are of importance to the Reform Rabbinate. And if it's important to the Reform Rabbinate, it's going to be important to the retired Reform Rabbinate. So, I think we're going to try to do some things. And the possibility exists next year. We're going to be in California, in the San Diego area. We may do some social action project over the weekend that we're there. We may do a project or two because something we might need to do.
And the OR has organizationally a newsletter and a website, correct?
And a website.
Why don't you mention that real fast?
Well,
before I end.
We do have a newsletter called OR Lenore, OR Lenore, and we have a website which is not well used, but it's there.
And
I don't know the name of it.
Naor.org.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I'm one of those people who would rather talk on a phone than do texts.
But as younger colleagues begin to retire, you know, they live on their iPhones or whatever.
I agree.
So Rabbi Steve Foster, president of the National Association of Retired Reform Rabbis, from Denver, Colorado, Rabbi Emeritus, right? Temple Emanuel?
7 years, 7.5 years.
Mazel tov. I thank you for giving up your time here, just sharing some of your thoughts and ideas about this very, very important organization. Only one of its kind, evidently. And so continued good luck. I wish you well,
thank you. You look great. You look happy.
I am happy. Can't complain. Complain.
And you're not retired.
No, just Jewish sacred aging. That's my life. You'd be good.
It's wonderful.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. This is Rabbi Richard Address at Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Thank you very much for listening.
I want to thank all of you for being a part of today's broadcast here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio with Gary and Rabbi Foster. These shows will be archived as podcasts on both Blog Talk Radio and our own website, JewishSacredAging.com. I want to invite again your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com, or liking us and giving us your comments on the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And a reminder that these shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, under the supervision and control of our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Thanks again, Steve. To all of you again, thank you for listening, and we look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you. Shalom. Have a great week. See you next time.